I recently had a birthday, and although I won't say which one, I'll tell you that I land somewhere in that ever-expanding realm between young adult and middle-aged. I fall in that age where I've been witness to a lot of technological transitions. Records to tapes to CDs, VCRs to DVDs, dial-up to broadband, car phones to iPhones. We've made a lot of progress in my lifetime, but not nearly as much as in the lifetime of my grandfather.
First, fella must get a target to shoot at because control is just as important as speed. Next, we've got to get someone to measure the speed of the pitch. This gentleman in blue claims that he can clock anything on wheels. Well, a baseball doesn't travel on wheels, officer. But if you want to race, it's your motorcycle.
This is from a video from 1940, 73 years ago. It features Bob Feller, a then 21-year-old pitcher who had already amassed 55 wins and over 700 strikeouts. Rapid Robert had a reputation for being baseball's fastest pitcher at the time, so Major League Baseball, as sort of a half-experiment, half-publicity stunt, decided to test Feller's pitch speed as best they could. This is 14 years before the invention of the radar gun, mind you, so they had to do a little improvising. They set up two giant pieces of paper on a closed-off street in Chicago and employed a city policeman to race Bob Feller's fastball on a motorcycle. They timed it as best they could, but as the replay shows, the motorcycle, which was going 86 miles an hour, still got a bit of a head start. Feller's pitch broke the paper a split second before the policeman. Reviews and calculations were performed, and it was ruled that Feller, throwing from flat ground in a shirt and tie, tossed a baseball 104 miles per hour. You can see how Feller led the league in strikeouts for seven seasons. This was perhaps not the most cutting-edge way to clock a fastball in 1940, but it made for good video. This experiment seems quaint nowadays, as radar guns can be found in the hands of scouts even at high school games. But the world has changed so much since Bob Feller's playing days. Cell phones, microchips, open-heart surgery, putting a man on the freaking moon, this all happened post-1940. So why would the baseball world be any different? In a time where scientific breakthroughs are happening seemingly every year, baseball is making its strides too. Sure, the ballparks have more technology, but what about the study of the game itself? How far have we come since Bob Feller raced a motorcycle cop with his fastball? From the John Montgomery Ward Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm your host, David Temple. In this episode, we take a look at science, and it's... you know what? I can do better than that. We take a look at...
science!
And its ever-changing effect on baseball. We're covering all sorts of areas, from physics to meteorology to biology to chemistry. We'll talk to Dr. Alan Nathan, a physics professor who has found some interesting data regarding the scientific relationship of bats and balls.
By and large, the bat weight does not matter a great deal in terms of how fast that ball will end up coming off the bat.
Then Ben Collin shares some interesting research he's been doing on baseball and the weather. And injury writer Will Carroll shares his unique take on losing players to the disabled list.
And if you told the Yankees that they were losing $4 million on theft, or that their restaurants weren't selling as well and they were going to lose $4 million, they'd do something about it right now. With injuries, they go, oh, that's sad.
All that plus a very scientific MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. We start every episode of Stealing Home with a little bit of news as we check in on the goings-on in baseball. Today, we welcome Bill Parker, featured columnist for SB Nation and co-founder of theplatoonadvantage.com. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bill, the World Baseball Classic is officially underway. We're already a few games in. We've seen Brazil give the defending champion Japanese team a little bit of a scare, as well as the Netherlands beating Korea. With the North American and most of the European teams still to play, what can we expect going forward?
Well, it's hard to say. It'll be interesting. Obviously, the players that most people in this country are familiar with are still to come. And so there's probably you're going to see a lot more attention paid to this over the coming week than we have over the last few days. But Japan certainly has a very strong team. I know in Vegas, the U.S. is a co-favorite along with the Dominican Republic. I think the interesting thing will be to see how the U.S. performs compared to these other teams, many of which are preparing specifically for this event, whereas many of the U.S. players are in spring training and are in the past two World Baseball Classics have performed very much like it was spring training. So I think the making the U.S. a co-favorite is a bit optimistic, and it'll be interesting to see how they perform against these teams that have been prepared for this and are, you know, more or less in full season form right now.
This is the time of year when clubs work on getting an idea of what their lineups and rotations will look like. But we've got bad news coming from the Cubs regarding their rotation. What's going on with staff ace Matt Garza?
He's got a lat problem, apparently, that was just announced on Sunday, that they expect him to possibly miss as much as the first full month of the season and return in May. This is really bad news, obviously, for the Cubs. Most people were not expecting them to go anywhere this year, but it's a real problem for Matt Garza's potential trade value. You've got, you know, the trade deadline coming up in July, and if he's missing a full month, and you have to figure he's going to take some time to get back into form after that, it's going to be really hard for him to kind of build up that value that they might look for in a trade. He's still got plenty of time to put in a strong season and hit the free agent market next year, but the Cubs have to be really disappointed that, you know, he's going to be missing a month in a time when they would probably like to showcase him to other teams as a trade target.
And of course, it wouldn't be the offseason if the Yankees weren't in the news. News has come up about the Yankees offering a contract extension to second baseman Robinson Cano, who, if nothing changes, will be a free agent after this season. We're getting mixed reports on what, if anything, was offered. Bill, are we to make anything of this, or is it just sort of spring training column fodder?
It's a weird situation, but I don't think there's much that can be made of it right now. I mean, Brian Cashman announced for some reason that they had made a significant offer to Cano. I think the natural presumption is that he turned it down or will be turning it down because Scott Boras and Cano have not commented and do not plan to comment. But it's, you know, it'll be a story that keeps coming up, you know, until he signs or doesn't. I suspect he's going to sign. The Yankees are not the team that's likely to give away a player like Cano get away. But it's interesting, you know, he is represented by Scott Boras. He is said to be looking for a 10-year contract, you know, with very high dollars that would pay him through age 40. And you've got the Yankees who are still dealing with A-Rod and a number of aging players that they're paying a great deal of money to, and they're not going to be too in too much of a hurry to commit themselves to something like that again. So it'll be, you know, you look at it and think, well, the Yankees have to pay him. He's their best player. They've got them, you know, the most money. They keep their players. That's just what they're going to do. But at the same time, there are real reasons for them to hesitate here. And the sides seem likely to be pretty far apart right now. So it will become an interesting story to follow. I'm not sure that there's all that much that can be said about it right now.
Another common theme in spring training news is the prototypical story of the player who defied all the odds to make it to camp with a big league team. These stories often involve injuries or some sort of substance abuse or family issues, but a recent article by Andrew Baggerly of CSN talks about the Giants' Brock Bond and the interesting odds pitted against him. Can you tell us a little more about Brock Bond's story?
Yeah, the Giants drafted him by accident back in 2007. In the 24th round, they intended to draft another Bond, a Casey Bond, who was a center fielder, and they picked Brock Bond by mistake. Had to go back and pick Casey Bond in the following round. Now, 5 or 6 years later, Casey Bond is out of baseball, and Brock Bond has been doing very well, is finally in his first big league camp, and is struggling to try to make the team. So it's a really interesting story. A guy who, you know, who knows if he would have been drafted or what may have happened if the Giants hadn't taken him, but they certainly didn't intend to take him, and now here he is in the big league camp.
And the other Bond, the Casey Bond, turned out to be an actor and actually played the part of Chad Bradford in the Moneyball movie, which I thought, I don't know, it's just weird how everything comes full circle like that.
Yeah, that was really funny. Yeah, I forgot about that part.
And finally, we turn to the utterly silly story of spring training, this one coming out of Milwaukee. Bill, can you tell us about the case of the mysterious missing sausage?
Right. So the Italian sausage costume, they were apparently at some event a couple weeks ago, and someone wearing that costume just walked out. Actually made a couple other appearances at bars around town. Apparently everybody had a good time and laughed with him and whatever, and then he just disappeared. And it's about a $3,000 costume, so it's not, you know, people are making it a big joke. I imagine it wasn't as much of a joke to the Brewers. But then it just disappeared for a couple of weeks. Nobody heard anything about it. And then last week, I think it was Wednesday, at another bar in town, apparently someone just kind of walked in, put the costume down, said you didn't see anything, and walked back out. So the Italian sausage has been returned. And probably the strangest story of the year so far.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be the sausage race in Milwaukee if the Italian sausage wasn't there.
Right. No, gotta have that.
Bill Parker writes for SB Nation as well as the Platoon Advantage. You can find him on Twitter at Bill_TPA. Thanks for coming on, Bill.
Thank you, David.
I first saw Dr. Alan Nathan at the Sabre Convention here in Minneapolis this past summer. He was doing a presentation about physics and baseball, and I found it to be so fascinating that I knew it wouldn't be a show about
science
without a chat with him. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois and has done a ton of research about the physics of baseball. I spoke with him over the phone. Dr. Nathan, thank you so much for joining us on Stealing Home.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It seems like many people take their interest of baseball and combine it with other interests, be it art or business or music or, in your case, physics. Can you tell us a little bit how you got started in physics and how that transitioned to baseball as well?
Oh, okay. Interesting question. Well, I think I knew I wanted to be a physicist way back when I was in the fifth grade, and I'm not even sure I could even pronounce it correctly at that point. And I can't even recreate why I somehow knew that, but I knew that. On the other hand, I think my interest in baseball is even longer than that. But it took a long, long time before I figured out how I could do both of them at the same time. And that happened, maybe 14 years ago or so, when I was asked by my department to give a talk to some high school honors students. And usually when we do these things, we talk about our own research. But I decided I would talk about the physics of baseball, mainly because I wanted to learn something about it. I had not even thought about it before. There was this new book that had just come out, on the physics of baseball. And I decided, all right, I'm going to read the book, and I'll learn something, and then I'll talk to the high school students about it. So I did that, and it turned out much better than expected in that there was a reporter in the audience who wrote it up in the local newspaper, and then people started calling me and wanted me to give talks about it, and it sort of expanded from there.
thanks a great deal to the recent success of R.A. Dickey, there seems to be a newfound fascination with the knuckleball. There's been a documentary about it. There's been a reality competition show on MLB Network. You've done some research on the knuckleball. Can you tell us what makes it such a special pitch, at least from a science standpoint?
Sure. Clearly from a fan's perspective, it's a very interesting pitch, just because it just seems to be so different than all the other kinds of pitches. And from a science point of view, the interest is also pretty much the same in that it behaves differently than normal pitches do. So when you look at normal pitches, a four-seam fastball, a curveball, a slider, it behaves in a more or less predictable way. So if you look at a given pitcher's repertoire of whatever he happens to throw, a four-seamer, two-seamer, slider, curveball, sinker, and you look at how those pitches move as they go through the air, and their movement is governed by two forces: the force of gravity, which is always pulling the ball down, and then the so-called Magnus force on a spinning baseball. If you look at how those pitches move, it all moves in a fairly predictable way. You know, the four-seam fastball is going to have a rise to it. I mean, it doesn't really rise because gravity is pulling down on it, but it doesn't drop as much as it would if it were not spinning. With a two-seam fastball, it tends to ride in. Thrown by a right-handed pitcher, it rides in on a right-handed hitter. Curveball mostly drops and goes away from the arm towards the glove side, et cetera, et cetera. They're all very, very predictable. And if you know what pitch is coming, you could pretty well guess where it's going to end up. Knuckleball is very different in that nobody really knows what it's going to do. It's released, and it also undergoes some kind of movement, left, right, up, down. But from one pitch to another, it's totally unpredictable, or so it seems. And when you look actually at data, and nowadays we have voluminous amounts of data that track the pitch ball in every major league game, you can look at the data and you see that the movement on the knuckleball is all over the place, whereas the movement on ordinary pitches tend to be clustered in certain directions. So that in and of itself is fascinating, and it goes a long way towards explaining not only why it's so difficult to hit, but also why it's so difficult to catch. The catcher doesn't even know where it's going to go. But I was actually, and that's been known. People have known that ever since this tracking system was installed in Major League ballparks 6 or so years ago, 7 years ago maybe by now, we've known that about knuckleballs. I was interested actually in something a little bit different than that. I was interested to know whether any given knuckleball trajectory is a smooth trajectory. It might be breaking in a random direction compared with other knuckleball pitches, but does it follow a smooth trajectory, much like a fastball does or a curveball does? And so that was the question that I posed, and then it turned out then I had data where I could try to answer that question. So that sort of led to my own interest in this topic, which is still ongoing. The initial study that I did has been, you know, it's been up on the web and people have looked at it, but it's an ongoing study. Just yesterday morning, I had 3 phone calls from reporters wanting to know about knuckleballs. So it's something of interest. It's something that I'm still working on, and I suspect for the next few months or so, we'll continue to work on.
At the risk of losing credibility in the science community, not that I had any to begin with, I must admit I'd never heard of the term coefficient of restitution until I heard your presentation at the most recent Sabre convention. You've used this theory to explain, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but how the weight of the bat doesn't have much impact on the batted ball because the weight gained and speed lost, or vice versa, sort of cancel each other out. Can you explain a little bit more about how that works?
Okay, so the basic issue is this. Suppose you have two bats that, for the sake of argument, let's suppose they both have the same length, but one of them weighs a little bit more than the other. Okay, maybe it's a little bit fatter in the barrel. And all other things being basically equal, you want to ask the question, which one will perform better when you actually use it in the field? And by perform better, you have to be very careful how you define what you mean by that, because you could get a different answer depending on how you define it. So the way that I defined it for the purposes of this discussion anyway is when the bat meets the ball, the ball is going to come off with a certain speed, and in which case will you get the higher batted ball speed? So you look at that and you sort of try to figure that out. On the one hand, let's compare the heavy with the light. The heavier bat is going to have a more efficient collision with the ball, just because all other things equal, a heavier bat is going to hit a ball harder than a lighter bat, all other things equal. But, of course, all other things are not equal, because a batter is not going to be able to swing a heavier bat as fast as a lighter bat. So these two things sort of play off against each other, so that by and large, the over some range of bat weights, the bat weight does not matter a great deal in terms of how fast that ball will end up coming off the bat. So if that's how you want to define the performance of a bat, it's more or less the same for a lighter bat or a little bit heavier bat. So, for example, this has implications for the so-called cork bat discussion. Batters sometimes, hopefully not too often, illegally cork their bat. So you take a wood bat, you drill a hole in it in order to make it lighter. And the idea is you can get higher bat speed that way. But the trade-off is you have a less efficient collision. And as I said, those two things play off against each other and essentially cancel out, if you want to think of it that way. So you don't really have any net advantage in terms of batted ball speed by using a lighter bat like that. But that doesn't mean you don't have some advantage. You may not hit the ball harder, but you're likely to make good contact more often if you use a lighter bat. You can probably wait just a little bit longer on each pitch. And once you've started to swing the bat, you can make small adjustments in your swing once the swing is begun, as you get more information on what the pitch ball is doing. So you have better bat control and you're likely to make good contact more often with a lighter bat, but you're not going to hit the ball harder. That was the conclusion.
Okay. Now, I just saw a recent article from maybe a few days ago about Yoenis Cespedes, who was taking batting practice, just kind of messing around in spring training, and actually hit a home run in batting practice with a donut on his bat, a batting donut, not a pastry. Now, I think, I forget what those clock in at, something like 28 ounces or something. Does that still fall within that range of collision, more efficient collision with that still, or does that fall out of that range?
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me that someone could hit a home run in batting practice. This was batting practice, right?
Right, yeah.
things become a little bit different in a batting practice type of situation, because more than likely in a batting practice type of situation, you could probably swing the bat faster than you normally would. And the reason is that the pitch is quite predictable. I mean, when they're throwing batting practice to you, they're not trying to fool you. So you're not holding back at all. As an example, let me just say, we've done experiments with elite slow pitch softball players measuring their bat speed in an actual kind of not really a game situation, but a situation where they're being lob pitches, slow pitch softball. And they have bat speeds that for sure exceed the typical bat speed of a major league ball player. Not even close. I mean, we measured bat speeds over 90 miles an hour, which is unheard of. That would be an enormous bat speed. And why can they get such high bat speed? Because they're not at all worried about, you know, timing issues. The ball is just floating in there. They're not worried about getting fooled by the pitch. So they have all the time in the world to just sort of load up and just swing it as hard as they can. And a Major League Baseball player can't do that. So in a sense, there's no real penalty for using a heavier bat under those circumstances. So the penalty that you normally would get in terms of swing speed, you don't have. And so you get all the benefits of the heavier bat with a donut. But in a batting practice situation, you don't get any of the drawbacks. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that he hit a home run.
And another sort of thing that you found with this, some of this research, has to deal with something that kind of took at least baseball nerds something that they found interesting quite a bit last year, which was a no-handed home run hit by Todd Frazier of the Reds. Now you decided, or actually, you know, instead of me prepping you, why don't you just go ahead and explain it so I don't butcher it?
Okay, fine. Yeah, so last year, it was over Memorial Day weekend, Todd Frazier hit a so-called no-hands home run. So if you go and look at the slow-motion video replay, what you see is that his top hand, by the time the ball and the bat were in contact, the top hand was totally off the bat, and the bottom hand was very, very loosely in contact. And shortly after that, no hands are on the bat. So in some sense, he literally threw the bat at the ball and made good contact and hit a, what, 375-foot home run or something of that nature. It was a decent home run. So what's going on there? Well, this was, if you like, right on my sweet spot. I mean, this is something that the very first piece of baseball research, I mean, genuine research that I did was way back, in 1998, 1999, that period where I developed a model for the ball-bat collision, a model that takes into account the vibrations of the bat and all that sort of stuff. And that was one of the first things that emerged from that study was that because the ball-bat collision is so rapid, you know, the ball and bat are in contact for maybe a thousandth of a second or less, because it's so rapid, there's really nothing that the batter can do on the handle end of the bat to influence what happens to the ball once that ball and bat are in contact with each other. It's just much, much too fast. And it's because, it's simply because of non-rigid nature of the bat. The bat is not a rigid body. And so in some real sense, on that very, very short time scale of a thousandth of a second, the barrel end of the bat, or the ball, which is in contact with the barrel end of the bat, doesn't even know the handle end of the bat is there. So nothing on that end of the bat, the handle end, matters as far as the collision is concerned. The knob of the bat, the thickness of the handle, or the batter's grip. Nothing could possibly matter. And that's a tune that I've been sort of preaching really for a decade or so. Whenever I give talks on the subject, and I've engaged in long discussions with people about it, and people generally don't believe it. They or let me just say it maybe a little bit more politely. It goes completely against their instincts, and it should go against their instincts. But it's the physics is well understood, and so when this event occurred, I remember I got an email from somebody very late that night, say, "Did you see this?" And I immediately, you know, went to my computer, took a look at it, and started writing up a little article about it, because it just showed as vividly as you could possibly imagine what I've been basically saying anyway for many years. So it was a kind of a fun demonstration of physics in action.
You got your retribution. I can kind of see where they're coming from. I mean, it does kind of go against everything you think, but from a pure science standpoint, I mean, I read, you know, I saw your presentation and I read your article about it on your site. And it makes perfect sense, you know, even though your brain's fighting you the whole way. It's a really, really interesting subject.
Right.
Do you have any, I don't know if you can divulge, but do you have any upcoming projects or research topics that you're working on right now?
Oh, yeah. As I said, I'm still working on the knuckleball. But for the moment, I'll tell you what I'm working on today. Literally, just before you called, I'm trying to utilize information on the batted baseball. So nowadays we have very good information, not only on the tracking of the pitch ball, but also of the batted ball. Again, there are two different systems. There's a system of cameras that does it. There's also a radar-based system where you can measure the speed and angles of the ball coming off the bat, and you could actually even measure the full trajectory. And so if you here's the problem I'm trying to solve. Suppose I know the full parameters of the pitch. I know, you know, exactly how that pitch is coming into home plate, and I also know what happens to the ball on its way out. Can I figure out what happened in between? Can I figure out how the what happened when the ball met the bat? So, for example, can I figure out how fast the bat was swung? Can I figure out the angle at which the bat was oriented? How squared up the collision was? In other words, did the ball meet the bat sort of head on, or was the bat a little bit above the ball or below the ball? Can I figure all those things out? And that's sort of the thing that I've been working on. I've been working on this problem on and off for a couple of years now, but now it's on again. So, yeah, that's the problem. That's my current passion, is trying to solve that. This is a problem. The first thing to try to figure out is there a unique solution? I mean, that's the first thing to figure out. And then if there is a unique solution to that problem, can I figure out what that solution is? So that's sort of what I'm working on these days.
Interesting. So you're basically taking two sets of data that up till recently haven't really been available, and sort of trying to reverse engineer a solution out of this to see if you can happen at that blink of an eye, less than a blink of an eye, of time when the bat actually meets the ball.
That's an excellent description of what I'm trying to do. Yep.
Interesting. Okay. Very cool. Dr. Nathan, I know very little about physics, but you've managed to trick me into reading about it thanks to your work with baseball, and I have to imagine I'm not the only one you've tricked. Thanks so much for joining us on Stealing Home.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Dr. Alan Nathan is a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. You can find his research on the physics of baseball at baseball.physics.illinois.edu, and you can follow him on Twitter at POBGuy. He's doing a presentation at the Saber Analytics Conference taking place in Arizona, March 7th through the 9th, so check that out. Hey, everybody. If you like the show, make sure to rate and review us on iTunes. A lot of you have been nice enough to do so already, but if you haven't, please go to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review. These help us stay current and relevant on the front pages of the iTunes podcast pages, which means more listeners, which means more popularity, which means better guests, and therefore better shows. You get the idea. So please go to iTunes if you haven't already, give us a rating, give us a review, and thanks a lot. Ben Cullen is not your prototypical meteorologist. He's not a TV weatherman. They don't interview him on CNN when a big storm is looming. But he's studied weather and ways of predicting it using computer software.
I'm from Wynn, Minnesota, and we had the only class in the state that had a meteorology class. And we took a field trip down to Oklahoma to visit that's like the mecca for weather, severe weather tracking and stuff, and that was in 1999, and I ended up seeing the May 3rd tornado outbreak down there, and that pretty much cemented my path in meteorology, and I ended up going up to the University of North Dakota and got my degree in atmospheric sciences there. But I also ended up seeing how powerful software can be, and taught myself how to write code and stuff like that in my spare time, and then ended up getting a job doing that for a meteorologist, writing software for meteorologists up at a private meteorology firm in Grand Forks.
So in his spare time, Ben started posting about weather and ways it would impact upcoming baseball games. It started first on his blog, That's Twins Baseball, but soon it blossomed to its own destination, bleacherweather.com. If you go there now, you'll see info about current spring training games, as that's the only thing going on, really. But once the season starts, you can check the upcoming weather for any game happening that day.
Well, once the season gets going, I'll end up having the daily schedules on there. And so you won't see all the – even the spring training, I'm a little behind on that, but usually I just go to the MLB game day data site and find what games are on. And then the only games that would be – or the only things plotted on the map would be today's games that are played. And I do the same thing for football and college and NFL each week. I do that. But I also just leave up the NFL and the other stadiums themselves just in case people just want to see what the weather is for a certain stadium, if there's something else going on there, different events.
And while this information is invaluable for fans planning on attending a certain game, it helps out fantasy players as well as gamblers, too. If you want to have all the data available before placing a bet or setting a fantasy roster, Bleacher Weather is a place you should visit. But Ben's not done yet. He's working on a model right now for predicting the weather's influence on batted balls inside the stadium, starting with his hometown park of Target Field. He's building a database that cross-references weather patterns when home runs are hit, because the weather doesn't stay the same from the beginning of the game to the end.
See, and sometimes I haven't been able to find it anywhere else, but like in the game day XML files or just things like that, there's always somebody that keeps track of the weather at the first pitch, and that's all the weather information they can find. And that's kind of the reason I went back and did this, is because I can find at least hourly data, and you can go back. There's even 5-minute reports from the nearest weather station. Just little things like that, you get more precision on the data, I guess, compared to just if you just looked at the beginning notes from game days.
And so Ben continues to work on his projects. There's now a mobile version of Bleacher Weather, so you can check ballpark weather on the go from your smartphone. And he's working on adding hourly forecasts in the coming weeks. Between that and constantly posting about game day weather and answering weather questions on Twitter, he's a busy guy. Especially considering that it's not even his day job. What Ben does interests me because it's not scientific research for the scientific crowd. It's stuff that affects everyone. No matter if you're going to the game, want to know if your favorite team is going to get rained out, or if a pitcher might be helped or hurt by certain wind patterns, there are people looking into this stuff and sharing it with you. And that's great. Because to me, that's what research is all about. What's the fun in keeping it to yourself? A big thanks to Ben Collin for talking with me. You can find him online at bleacherweather.com, that's twinsbaseball.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at BennyC50. We've touched on sciences that affect the players externally, but what about biology? What about the players themselves? Despite all the advances we've made, players' bodies still get injured. They get injured all the time. There were 486 disabled list stints that occurred in 2012 alone. But research is still going on to keep players healthy and on the field, or if they do get hurt, to get them back as soon as possible. My guest, Will Carroll, has been covering efforts like these for years. He's one of the premier injury experts when it comes to sports. He's written for Baseball Prospectus and Sports Illustrated, and recently joined Bleacher Report, where he continues his award-winning coverage. Will, thanks so much for coming on Stealing Home.
Hey, I'm excited. Thanks a lot, David.
You mentioned at the beginning of almost all your bios that you are not a doctor. However, you've become one of the premier sources for injury news and analysis when it comes to sports. How did you get started in this field of reporting?
Wow, you know, dumb luck is basically it. Really, for me, I think the best writers are the people that are writing about something they're passionate about. You know, Peter Gammon's phenomenal because he loves baseball so much. Peter King is so great because he's passionate about sharing the knowledge he has and the information that he gleans. And for me, I just couldn't find something like that. And, you know, it was basically just what I wanted to read. And I've been around sports medicine my whole life. Like you said, I'm not a doctor. I'm certainly not a reporter, though I've kind of learned on the job over the last 12 years. And for me, it was just getting the same information. I can remember the first email I sent out to three people. It was seven injuries, no commentary whatsoever. And I asked them, is this anything? And Jim Callis, who I was in a fantasy baseball league with, works at Baseball America, he was like, I don't know, send me one tomorrow. And it grew from there. I wish I had that first one, but I actually have the third one I ever sent out, and it looks frighteningly similar to what I do now, which I guess, you know, that's good and bad. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of growth, but maybe I was onto the right idea there at the start. So I've just been lucky. A lot of people, Rob Nyer, Peter Gammons, Peter King, there have been so many of my heroes, let alone great guys, who have helped me along the way, and this has grown and grown, and here I am now at Bleacher Report, one of the biggest sites in the country. I've written for a lot of places and done radio and TV. Never thought it would grow into this, but I'm excited other people want to hear this kind of information.
So I've heard things like that from multiple writers or you know, media producers or whatever. Basically, they were looking for something, and that something didn't exist, so they decided to be the person to do that. There's something very American about it. I like it.
Yeah, you know, I think it works for a lot of people, and, you know, a lot of people out there, I think, are going to find that next niche. You know, we've got, you know, when I started, blogs existed, but not a lot of people knew they existed. And so, you know, would I have gone that route? If I were starting today, would I have been one of the writers applying to write at Bleacher Report? Probably. Don't know if I'd be good enough because we turned down a lot of people. But I do think there's more niches. There are people out there that cover niches like nobody else. But I think there's still a whole lot of room out there for that kind of coverage. And you never know. You know, that niche might get bigger than you ever expected.
There's one thing we haven't touched on yet as far as the fans go, and that's the fan of playing fantasy sports, the ever-expanding world of fantasy sports. How big of an influence do you think that has had on people searching and seeking your specific kind of news?
I think it's helped. Certainly, you know, I was a fantasy player. That's why I got into this. I was trying to gain an advantage, and I had friends that knew I had a sports medicine background, and I could tell them whether that sprained ankle was going to be 4 weeks or 6 weeks. And so I think there is a broad population. But I don't think fantasy sports should be treated any differently than sports. Again, this is just a different way of watching the game. And I think for a league, they should definitely, definitely love fantasy sports. For God's sakes, I can't tell you how many times I've ended up watching, you know, the Padres or the Mariners back when they were bad, because I had Ichiro, or I was hoping Yasmani Grandal would hit one more home run. That, I think, is phenomenal. You know, it takes us outside our comfort zone. It makes us look at the game a different way. I love fantasy players, but I hate the fact that we've kind of ghettoized it and said, you know, fantasy sports is you know, something lesser than. I've never understood why it was actually divided off. I don't know who first did that at ESPN or who did that at Yahoo or wherever that happened, but I think fantasy is just another way of watching sports.
You report a lot about injuries, player injuries, and expected timetables for their return. On the other hand, there have been big steps taken in the way of injury prevention that teams have used. What are some new methods or techniques that you've noticed that work to combat injuries in the first place, prevent them from happening?
Wow. I wish there were a lot more
Certainly.
Of those. You know, unfortunately, we haven't done a very good job of prevention, and we've done a worse job of researching. And that one, that's on Major League Baseball. That one's on the individual team. Same thing in the NFL. You know, with Major League Baseball, they have not done a significant amount of research. Now, we've seen some change come in. You know, this year we're going to see the required use of the S100 helmet, which is a much better batting helmet. I don't think there's any reason that anybody would ever not use this. But I can remember a couple of years ago when David Wright first did it, the original design, the padding was a little less dense and it turned a little bigger. And I can't tell you how many people, fans and writers, made fun of the way it looked. Well, guess what? It's safer. I hated that attitude. I was like, you'd much rather him be less safe. And so you're gonna basically use the old schoolyard taunt until he took it off a couple days later and put himself at greater risk. A couple days ago, Curtis Granderson, in his first at-bat of the spring, took a fastball off his wrist and broke his forearm. He's going to miss 8 weeks, which is a cost of, I think it was just under $4 million in salary. That's a lot of money. And if you told the Yankees that they were losing $4 million on, you know, theft, or that their restaurants weren't selling as well and they were going to lose $4 million, they'd do something about it right now. With injuries, they go, oh, that's sad. You know, my response to a $4 million loss would be to say, how do we not do this? And there's this very simple solution to this. You know, my friends at EvoShield, a great and innovative company, have wrist guards that have padding inside of them made out of a proprietary gel. Now, I don't mean to say that Rawlings or Louisville Slugger or anybody else couldn't come up with something similar. I don't want to pretend that one company has a solution. I just know they have this product right now for sale, being worn by lots of professional baseball players. That $25 pad could have saved $4 million. If I'm the Yankees, I'm going out tomorrow. If I'm calling EvoShield, if I'm calling whoever, if I've got to go to Moe's and pick up all these pads for every single one of my players, I'm going to learn from that mistake. But you know what? They haven't. The players are not out there wearing the kind of guard. Mark Teixeira could get the same sort of hit that Curtis Granderson did and his arm's broken. Brett Gardner could get the same kind of hit. Robinson Cano could be hit in the same way, and his arm would likely break because they haven't changed anything. I so do not understand this. Last year, when Brandon McCarthy was hit in the head, he wasn't the first player to get hit in the head, but it was a pretty ugly one and probably the closest we've come in a while to losing a player on the field. Had to have brain surgery. Luckily, he's okay. He's pitching this spring, but he's pitching with the exact same gear he did last year. There was a lot of discussion about having some sort of padding in there. I know companies that have submitted designs, and they've done some testing. But at what point do we say, hey, let's speed this up. Let's get this going. You know, last year during the playoffs when they were talking about this, I can remember talking with Ken Rosenthal about this, I was able to take $10 worth of Kevlar padding, glued it inside a hat of mine that I had laying around, and Ken tweeted it out to the however 50 million people that follow him for his great work. If I can do it in 5 minutes, baseball should have done it by now. And the next time we see somebody get hit in the head, which unfortunately is going to happen, I can only hope it waits until we've got that padding and until we've required it.
And besides padding, there's also been some investigation into more of the biometric side for pitching to do some preventative work there as well. I know ESPN did a spread on that last year. Have you been following that at all?
Yeah, you know, I've been following that for years. My friend Glenn Fleissig from the American Sports Medicine Institute is the top guy in that field. And we actually talked about this on Monday, that he's seeing a little more uptake, that there's a few more teams. You know, even back in Moneyball, Rick Peterson was bringing people down to ASMI and getting things done. CeCe Sabathia several years ago had a shoulder problem and got a little scared and came down and had an analysis done, and he's been pretty good since then. So, you know, I would like to say there was a lot more of this. At this point, I know of about, I would say, somewhere between a third and half of the teams do this on some level. But there's only one, maybe two teams that do it with everybody. And to me, again, stunning. You know, the whole biometric setup doesn't cost that much if you wanted to have your own. If you want to send people to SMI, hey, you know what? You can buy them the plane ticket to Birmingham now when they're healthy and try to keep them that way, or you can buy them that plane ticket when they need to get their elbow worked on by Dr. Andrews. And that's going to be a little bit more expensive. So that's progressing, but very, very slowly. And again, I just don't understand why.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about it because I think it's going to be one of the pressing issues as far as injuries go. And I look forward to seeing your reports about it as well as your other reporting duties for Bleacher Report. Will Carroll, thank you so much for coming on Stealing Home.
Hey, hope we can do it again. Thanks a lot.
Will Carroll is a writer focusing on sports injuries. You can find his latest work at bleacherreport.com and follow him on Twitter at @injuryexpert. To end the show, we like to highlight someone from the baseball world who, for actions on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. We've covered physics, meteorology, and biology, and now it's time for a little chemistry. Doc Philip Ellis pitched 12 years in the major leagues. He won 138 games and struck out 1,136 batters. He pitched in two World Series in his time with the Pirates and Yankees and made the All-Star team in 1971. Lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as LSD, is a psychedelic drug which can cause hallucinations, synesthesia, and sensations of spiritual experiences. On June 12, 1970, in San Diego, California, these two entities met for what would turn out to be an historic baseball feat. That day, in the first game of a doubleheader, Doc Ellis pitched a no-hitter, high on LSD. Ellis would later blame the incident on some historically terrible time management, but he would admit to dropping acid about 6 hours before that game. He said he had a hard time seeing the catcher and batter, would suffer from hallucinations, and was really just trying as hard as he could to keep himself together over the course of that game. But when it was all said and done, he'd gone 9 innings, walked 8, struck out 6, and surrendered 0 hits. Baseball, over a long enough timeline, is all in all pretty monotonous. There are games, one team wins, another loses. There are some hits and some strikeouts and maybe a home run, but in whole, the same stuff happens every day. And that's okay, there's beauty in that. It mimics life that way. Most days you wake up, go to work, drive home, eat dinner, watch TV or read a book, go to bed, etc., etc. Rinse and repeat, ad infinitum. It's those outliers that make life worth living. It's the graduations, or finding $5 in an old coat, or free lunch at work, or going to a baseball game. That's what we should be shooting for. The rest is just filler. Doc Ellis's LSD game characterizes those outliers in baseball. In a game that imitates life, we need events that imitate these outliers. We need perfect games. We need Giancarlo Stanton breaking scoreboards with a home run. We need triple plays and late inning rallies and, to be honest, steals of home. These events break it up. These events snap us out of the regular and, for a brief moment, into the spectacular. If every minute of every day was this cool or exciting, we couldn't handle it. We'd go crazy. But we can handle it in small doses. And because Doc Ellis took a dose of LSD in 1970 and ended up in the history books, he gave us one of the best outliers in baseball history. And for that, he's the MVP of my heart. That's it for this episode of Stealing Home. My thanks to Bill Parker, Dr. Alan Nathan, Ben Collin, and Will Carroll. Don't forget to tell your friends about us and make sure to follow us on social media. You can check us out at Facebook at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio and on Twitter at stealinghome.org. You can get the show notes for this episode at stealinghome.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Stealing Home.